husband. Also, if you've never been here, we're okay in the back. That'd be great. I know most of you, but if you haven't met, my name is Annie Carter Wilkowski. I'm Tim and Daphne's youngest daughter. On behalf of our family, I want to thank you all for being here today. It's wonderful seeing all these people in this room who knew and loved our dad, Tim, and our family, and we sincerely appreciate you joining us to remember him, to enjoy food. Please help yourselves. We got a lot of desserts in honor of my dad, our dad's sweet tooth. And hopefully laugh some, because as you all know, humor was a big part of our dad's life, even in the later stages of his illness. And we're here today to mourn his loss, but also to feel joyful about the gifts that he brought to our lives. Our dad, Tim Carter Wilkowski, was born in Fort Lauderdale, Florida in 1952 to Elizabeth Wooding and Frank Joseph Wilkowski, who went by Will, Frank Joseph Wilkowski Sr. His parents met in central southern Virginia, where our grandma grew up, when our grandpa was working with the Civilian Conservation Corps. After they got married, they settled in Fort Lauderdale and had four sons, with our dad being the youngest. My sister and I always enjoyed hearing about our dad and his brother's antics when they were children in Florida in the 50s and 60s. We had a pretty different upbringing in suburban North Carolina. He used to tell us little boy stories. We have a few selections on the tables in this room. And these stories gave us insight into his exotic Florida upbringing. Just as one data point, our dad had two pet iguanas as a teenager, whereas we had a hamster. And there was a common theme to the little boy stories of limited parental oversight. I'm partially joking. They had loving parents, but it was a different time. And I will say, his childhood involved significantly more pyrotechnics than my sister's and mine. It was because of him that I learned at a surprisingly young age that you should not put water on a gasoline fire to extinguish it. But thankfully, I learned this secondhand, not firsthand, of my dad, and he stitched his eyebrows off. I don't think our dad would mind me telling the story of his memorial service, because he really didn't take himself too seriously, and he liked to joke about his trials and tribulations. Another classic story he told often was when he stapled his thumbs together, not as a kid, but during his first week of college. our dad grew up in Florida, went to Catholic school through high school, and then moved up north to North Carolina, where he attended Duke. He would at times get to and from college by hitchhiking between South Florida and Durham, North Carolina. He later got his master's from The Ohio State University and then returned to North Carolina for his PhD in public health from UNC, where he met our mom when they had adjacent study girls in the epidemiology department. And when they met, our mom had some reservations due to our dad's fashion choices. he was partial to a leather visor, and our dad thought our mom was very straight-laced, perhaps due to her Puritan New England upbringing. In any event, our parents moved past their initial impressions of each other, began dating, and ultimately were married in 1982. He had a career as an epidemiologist, first teaching at UNC and then working for many years at RTI International as a senior epidemiologist. So far today, I've been telling mostly secondhand stories, but obviously I remember our dad as our dad. Our mom has recalled that he was a great father of daughters, or in today's vernacular, a girl dad, and I very much felt that to be true. When I was a kid, he would tell me that women were better than men, which I don't agree with, for the record, but I did appreciate hearing that from my dad as a young girl. He enjoyed being the only guy in the house. He grew up with three brothers, and his mom died when he was 18. He really embraced being in a household full of women, including our cat, Rosie. He was also a secret fan of Gilmore Girls and always found a way to end up in the TV room when they were watching. He was also pretty candid about how he felt about certain things. For example, we watched a lot of Disney movies as kids, and he liked Mulan as a role model. But when my sister or I watched The Little Mermaid, and he walked in, every time he would inevitably ask, "Has Airhead learned to count to three yet?" So I knew that I should not aspire to be Ariel. Our dad was dedicated to being present and spending quality time with our family. What I remember from weekend mornings as a kid is waking up to classical music and him making scrambled eggs and toast for breakfast. We spent a lot of time at the creek and in the woods behind our house, also going on hikes by the Eno River or Okeechobee Mountain, or spending weekends at the farm in Virginia, which was always a special place to him. More often than not, when he was leaving the house to go for a run or to the store or to work, he would leave handwritten notes for us on the counter. Like on Monday mornings, he would leave a note saying, "Sweethearts, I'll miss you. I had fun with you this weekend." When I went to camp as a kid, he would take the time to write secret postcards to me in backwards handwriting, so I had to use a mirror to read them. And he wrote my sister many thoughtful letters when she was in college, which she has shared with me and we're both grateful to have. In so many ways, he put in the time and effort to be a good dad and show by example what he believed in and what mattered most. His core values and priorities, his sense of humor, his humility, his responsibility, and enjoyment of simple pleasures like dancing persisted even in his illness. For many years, even as his abilities declined, he would still sweep the kitchen floor every night. He was laughing and dancing up until his final week. Our Uncle Joe has said that he doesn't remember ever seeing our dad truly angry, at most pissed off. And we're fortunate that his gentleness lasted until the end of his life. There's one more story I'd like to share involving our family friend, Diane Goldbergs, in the back there. She's known our parents for about 40 years. She lives up the street from us. One day when our dad was still living at home but with advanced dementia, she called and left a voicemail saying that she needed a ride to the hospital because she had cut her leg badly and was bleeding. Our mom was in the yard or the woods at the time and got back to the house and saw that our dad was gone, which was abnormal because he never wandered. Ultimately, she was able to find him walking up the street, and when they got home, she heard the voicemail and realized that he'd been on his way to Diane's house because he heard the message and wanted to help. That was his instinct. Thankfully, Diane was okay. I've often wished that I had more time with our dad, but I take comfort in knowing that he'll continue to shape how I live my life. All of us being here today is a testament to the impact he made on each of us, and I hope all of you will carry his influence as well. As I wrap up, I'd like to recognize and thank everyone who cared for our dad during his illness, first and foremost our mom. And we're grateful to the many others who contributed to his care as well, especially the staff at Brookdale where he lived for the last 3 years of his life. And again, thank you all for being here today. And next we have Art Goldsmith.
Thank you. Can you all hear me without a microphone?
Yes.
Yes? No? Yes?
Project.
I'll project. How's that?
That's good.
Okay. Yeah. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm Goldsmith. My wife, Jane Kaufman, is with me today. And I want to thank Daphne and Libby and Andy for giving me this opportunity to share some thoughts about Tim with you. So, back in 1983, I had the good fortune to move to Chapel Hill from Storrs, Connecticut, to work at UNC. And on the first day that I was on the UNC campus, I was walking across campus, and I saw this guy with this very impressive mustache and long hair and this sort of really casual gait. Right? And you know, pretty clearly you know who I'm talking about. And I was thinking to myself, dude, that guy is either from Southern Florida or from California. No one in New England presents like that, right? And I learned he was a South Florida boy, right? And during that year, Jen and I saw this guy from afar, here and there, when we were in Chapel Hill and walking across campus. And one time we even saw him at our favorite bar, He's Not Here. So Tim was a bit of a celebrity. And fast forward a few months, we decided we were going to stay in Chapel Hill, and we bought a house in the woods. And shortly thereafter, we had this extraordinarily good luck. We got some new neighbors that were next door to us. And
there was that guy. He was stalking us or something.
And there was Tim Wilkoski and Abby Moran. Right? Talk about good fortune. Right? Well, Jan and I and Tim and Daphne became fast friends pretty quickly, and then before long, kids started to arrive, and their first, Libby and our first, Allison, were good buddies then, and they're still close today. Now, Tim liked to run, and he liked to hike. Those of you that know him or just saw some of that slideshow know that that was a big part of his life. And I was fortunate enough to join him on a number of occasions. And I often would ask him simple things about his job, right? And I quickly realized this guy is really a superb scholar. He's doing some fascinating and interesting work. And he was so creative. You know, Jan would be like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm going to go for a run with Tim, right? So we hang out for a while. And the ease and clarity with which he could explain real science, you know, I'm talking about like chemistry and biology and epidemiology. Kind of, it just really revealed to me what a humble and incredibly talented guy he was. And long before there was ever a TED Talk, Tim would give me these Tim Talks. And they were free. And they were really, really outstanding. And I used to think, how fortunate could anybody be? Well, over time, I learned that Tim was really good at lots of different things. But I want to start at the top of the hierarchy now. And you'll probably know this, that Tim was really a master of eating. And what he really enjoyed more than anything else in the world was chocolate chip cookies. Now, I have to say, he loved them. And he savored them. Not just eating, he could even talk about chocolate chip cookies. And they were no big thing to me, so maybe I need to rethink this, right? But eventually I came to realize that Tim was actually on to something, right? But here's how strong his attachment to chocolate chip cookies was. So, Libby, I think you're going to appreciate this. When Daphne went into labor, because you wanted out, right? She was in the process of making chocolate chip cookies, right? In fact, he had the oven warm and was ready to stick them in there, right? And that set up this amazing moment of what I would describe as tension. And Jared and I witnessed a major turning point in Tim's life. Because for a moment, actually maybe quite a few moments, we wondered, is he going to go to the hospital with Daphne? Or is he going to stay here and make those cookies? And it was just kind of quiet for a while. And after a period of deep reflection on his part, not mine, he turned to Jan and he said, can you finish baking these cookies for me? Because I have something more important to tend to. And at that moment, I recall thinking, wow, that's the power of love right there. Right? That Tim actually turned down bacon cookies, chocolate chip cookies, to be with Libby Bid, right? So, of course, the next day he had more than his fair share. Tim was obviously a really good father. He was a wonderful husband. He was a great neighbor. He was a caring person. But his love for music was paramount, right? Especially Motown, right? Like, my students don't even know at Washington Lee what Motown is. I had to actually assign them one day to go home and listen to Marvin Gaye. But Tim, he liked his Motown. He liked his soft rock, you know, Jackson Brown, the Eagles. But he also liked good old rock and roll, right? He liked the Allman Brothers. South Florida, good guy. He liked Grateful Dead and the Doobie Brothers. And he carried that love for music right into the memory care center. And I can say that with confidence, because there was never a problem finding Tim when Jan and I would go with Daphne to see him. All you had to do was follow the music. And when you got to the source, that was Tim, right? Yep, Jan and I had the good fortune to listen to a lot of interesting music with Tim over the years in a lot of different places. The last thing I want to tell you about is his love for hiking was really special. And I had a good fortune to hike a number of times with him in the Eno River Park and in Duke Forest. And I recall this amazing story. We were hiking along in Duke Forest once, and we sat down on these boulders, and we were watching these snapping turtles sitting on these trees that were out in the river just baking. And Tim liked to be warm. He liked sunshine, right? And I'm thinking, man, these snapping turtles are kind of like Tim. And they would sort of slip into the creek or this river, and they'd take a little dip, and then they'd get out, and they'd get back up on that log in exactly the same position they were in before, and bait for a while longer. And if you know Tim, like, he was in no rush to move on. We did quite a few cycles of drying, swimming, and drying before moving on, believe me, because Tim did not do hectic. Tim was a very sort of copacetic, patient guy, and he could relate to these turtles, and that was more good fortune. Well, you know, at the end of the day, Tim left a huge footprint. He was beloved by so many people. Just look around you right now, and you can feel that. Right? He touched all of our lives in such a positive way. So I just want to say thank you, Tim, and you'll always be with us. And that was truly good fortune.
Because they understood what we were saying. So we made our own language for them so they wouldn't know what we were saying. We were responsible pyromaniacs from a young age. Mom and Dad bought Tim a toy fire truck for Christmas one year. What's the sense of having a fire truck if you don't have fire? It had a little fire hydrant you would screw on the end of the hose. It had a hose that went from the fire hydrant to the truck. It had a wrench on top of the fire hydrant, little wrench. And we'd build stick fires in the flower beds. And Mom would be sticking her head out the door going, "You can't build any fires again?" Tim was really witty. He wrote a column for the high school newspaper called Wilkoski's Wit. And these are a couple of his little statements. "Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. That's why we have so many mirrors. I don't understand it. They spend billions going to the moon and come right back after they get there. History always repeats itself. It must have a very little imagination. Doctors warn us that loud music is destroying the teenager's hearing, but they just can't seem to listen. There's one sure way to keep you from growing old. It's called death." Tim really liked astronomy. We go out looking for shooting stars night after night, and we had seen two that were low enough and bright enough that lit up the ground. Tim did like to hike. He hiked across the Grand Canyon from the north rim to the south rim in one day. He and I took two trips to Jackson Hole to stay in the lodge, go for day hikes, and if it had gained an elevation, I'd always be saying, "I'll see you at the top, Jim." I couldn't keep his pace. He always liked music. I love him, and I will miss him. And thank you all for coming.
I've known Tim and their family forever, I think since about 1977. We came into Chapel Hill together. Tim was just a little bit farther ahead in his PhD program than I was, which was really helpful. He had the same advisor. So, and this was, I got stories to tell about him, but you don't know him, but you have to blast it down like this, and you look at you and you feel bad. But Tim helped me, and I'll never forgive him for that. But I do have a few little stories for you. One was something that my daughter, who's now 45, when she was about 2 years old, and we'd go visit Tim, and this was when he was living alone in this apartment that was sort of downstairs, and she'd crawl up on his lap, and he would give her his junk mail, and she would have the best time opening his junk mail. Now, my daughter, Nicole, her name for Tim was Old Fat Tim. No Tim. This was not, well, this was her name. And if you knew anything about his diet, which we talked a little bit about, let me tell you, I spent a lot of time with Tim. Breakfast, typically, at least that I saw, was a tub of yogurt. Lunch was this peanut bar. And then dinner, and I'll never forget this day when we went to visit him, it was boiled shrimp and a bag of potato chips. And he would sit there and eat, and this was not one of those little bags of potato chips, and that was a Tim dinner, well before Daphne took a hold of him and got him to eat a little more regularly. The second story, and this was when Tim, as we all know, was suffering from the beach, and we'd have him down to the beach, because we used to come to Emerald Isle Beach every other year for the last 40 years, even though we lived in Washington. We invited Tim and Daphne to come down, and this was when Tim was in the throes of his sort of nonverbal dementia. And I was talking one day, and I said this one word, and Tim brightened up and smiled and laughed. I mean, there's a little story behind it. When Tim first came to Chapel Hill, he lived a friend of Larry Clark and his wife, who lived outside of town. They had this dog. This was a little black dog. This was a little dog, black dog that did not smell very good. And Tim hated this dog. And so when I was there in a very nice house that we rented, and I mentioned the word Sahai, which was the dog's name, Tim brightened up. It was like I had turned him on, and he was shaking his head. He wouldn't say anything, but he was shaking his head. Oh, that's Sahai. One more story, because I asked another daughter, Sarah, who's now, we had our kids early. I asked her, "What do you know about Tim?" She said, "He showed me how he's come." As we know, Tim loved astronomy, and he had that really nice telescope up on the top of their house. And he would take us up there, and he showed my little daughter, Sarah, how he's come. I'll miss Tim. We spent a lot of time together. We knew each other really well. He has a wonderful family. And I'm so glad that he could come. My wife couldn't come today, unfortunately. But we don't live too far away. We're down in Wilmington. So thank you. Thanks for having me.
In the student room with Tim and Daphne in 1978, and Doug, you were a few feet away.
Yes, I was.
And you know, it was this little corner of the student room, and I had my back to Tim and Daphne, so I couldn't really see what was going on between them. But Tim, he was so smooth. I mean, I've never met somebody so, he just exuded confidence. It was incredible. And I was this nervous character. You know, I had been a health administrator. I didn't know Effie from Doodle. And you know, I immediately knew this guy, smart, probably knows tons more than I do. And because he's right behind me, I could talk to him about our assignments. And we got a very tough Effie assignment. So we had this brutal TA, you know, who was torturing us. And so we all got it wrong except him. And I knew from that point, you know, this is the guy you need to talk to. And several times I would do an assignment, it was either Effie or BIOS, and I would turn to Tim, and I would ask him, I would show him my homework, and say, Tim, what do you think? That, you know, is this about right? And he would look at it and kind of smile and say, know that you could have saved a lot of time if you had done it this other way. But he said it with, you know, humility, so he wasn't trying to you know, lecture me. And that was Tim, you know, just not cocky, just confident, just, you know, it was just in his bones. I'm really lucky to have had a long career in federal government and public health. And I have to say that without Tim's help, it might not have ever happened. I mean that seriously. In our first or second year of the UNC EPI experience, we went to a party up on Wade Road, which was Larry Clark's house. And I had never met Larry. I didn't know who Larry was, but he was an advanced EPI student. He was a year or two ahead of us. He didn't hang around the student room very much, so I didn't really know him. But because of getting invited to that party, I got to know Larry a little bit. And so that, you know, we weren't great friends, but, you know, we knew each other, we could talk. And it turns out that 3 years later, in 1982, a bunch of us were at the Society for Epidemiological Research in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I was looking for a job in a big way. It was 1982, President Reagan had just taken over, and federal employment was, you know, sort of going downhill. And I let Tim know that, you know, I was looking for a job. He said, well, let me see if I can find Larry. I think he's here. So he did. And Larry came and got me and said, Liv, come on, I want you to meet this guy. He was a former classmate of mine who graduated from UNCW. And we sat down and I talked to Wayne, and that was my first employment in public health at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. That was the beginning. I have no idea if that hadn't happened. I have no idea what would happen. So I am eternally grateful for Tim introducing me to Larry and subsequently asked it happen. Let me tell you the funniest thing that stuck in my mind about Tim. He was living in the basement of this apartment building that we lived in. We had sort of given him a chance to pick the apartment, and of course, you know, it took, because it was like four blocks from school, so it was great. And I noticed he had a stack of Time magazines in the basement there. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. It's like a year's worth of Time magazines. And didn't think a whole lot about it. But it turned out he'd been carrying these things around with him for a while. And Tim and I and Doug and Daphne and a bunch of other EPI students went to the University of Minnesota in the summer of 1979. And, you know, most of us flew there. We didn't carry a lot of luggage. I think Tim drove there. He afraid it's Time Magazine. And in Minnesota, we were living in a dorm. It was pretty Spartan. I don't know whether they had mini fridges or not. So we went looking for beer a couple of times, and they had 3-2 beer in Minneapolis. And we looked at it and thought, 3-2 beer? That's really beer. And so we finally, there was like a real liquor store, and they had strong beer. So we loaded up in the strong beer, took some back, and stashed it in our dorm rooms. And then one night, I guess maybe it was toward the end when we had finished our courses, we were feeling really great. You know, we learned some stuff. And we went up on the roof and watched the sunset. And a bunch of us were up there. I don't remember if you were there were three or four of us up there. We were listening to music on a boom box and just kind of gyrating and drinking beer. And Tim came up a little later, and he brought a stack of Time. and instead of listening to the music, which, was a little out of character, he said, or maybe he was listening and just not paying, it was not a big deal. He sat down, leaned up against the wall on the roof, and he started reading the Time magazine. He stayed up there until after midnight. And I don't know how many he went through, but it was a lot. I don't know what the point of that is. Tim, he was like that. He would do things that nobody else would do. He was amazing and brilliant. And I am so lucky to have known Tim. It's just something that I'll hold in my heart forever. And so thank you all for inviting us.
Please come by and say hi again. Thank you all.